Since human beings first appeared on the scene, we've been sustained by the Earth's bounty. We're constantly finding more and more ingenious ways to partake of this richness. We've come a long way since we invented our first nets and spears. Technology has allowed us to go to the ends of the Earth, or even the bottom of the ocean, to get whatever we want. Earth's production of food and minerals and every kind of material has seemed limitless. But the planet is finite, so there have to be limits. How can we know when we're exceeding those limits and using too much? When it comes to creatures other than humans, we can measure the number of organisms a given ecosystem can support. Ecologists call this carrying capacity. Many people, especially economists, argue that the planet can sustain our present numbers and more because we aren't like other animals. We're intelligent and inventive, they say, and this has enabled us to go beyond our biological roots. Bill Reese is a population ecologist at the University of British Columbia.
Many economists reject completely the notion of carrying capacity when it's applied to human beings. And the reason is that obviously we engage in cultural things such as trade. And why should any population in a given region be limited by the resources in that region if it can import those things that might be in short supply locally? So the idea here is that almost any place on the planet, any significant region, will have certain things in surplus and other things may be scarce. But if we're creative, we can trade our surpluses for those things that are locally scarce. And that enables both us and other regions to overcome our local carrying capacity. The population then can rise. The consumption of goods and services can rise far beyond the capacity of a local area to support that population. The other critical factor here is technology. And many people believe that as technology improves, we'll be able to substitute for any resource that gets scarce, even generally scarce. In other words, if it's not even available for trade, it doesn't really matter, because human ingenuity can substitute for any good or service provided by nature. At least that's the theory. So when you put the whole issue of trade and technological advance in the basket, it seems that carrying capacity is an irrelevant concept for human beings.
If carrying capacity doesn't limit human beings, what is our world based on? Economists believe it's human inventiveness and productivity that create wealth and satisfy our every need. As an ecologist, this didn't make much sense to Bill Reese.
Well, I toyed with that idea for a long time because it seemed to me to violate something intrinsic or inherent about human beings, and that is that for all our technological wizardry, we're still real animals, we're still organisms dependent on physical processes and physical materials. The fact is that under any system of trading or under any level of technological development, each of us requires a certain productive area on the surface of the Earth to maintain our current patterns of consumption.
What Bill Reese tells us is that regardless of where our goods come from or the state of our technology, we still have to get our raw materials from the Earth. He has worked out a way to actually measure the amount of the Earth's surface it takes to support each person on the planet. It's called our ecological footprint.
Ecological footprinting is a technique we've developed here at UBC, which really measures the load that a given population imposes on nature. Now, if you think of something simple like, well, grain. If everybody eats a certain amount of bread, you require grain, and everybody knows that grain grows on the land. So it's not hard to understand that if we know the average level of consumption of, say, wheat, we can convert that very readily into the average amount of wheat land required to support a single person. Well, if you simply extend that to the entire shopping basket of goods, I mean, I'm wearing cotton pants and, a silk shirt or a woolen socks or whatever. Each of those things has a land component, as does our paper and our wood requirements and so on. It's a little trickier when thinking of wastes, but the fact of the matter is that carbon dioxide, if we're going to have a sustainable society, needs to be assimilated.
Our wastes are dumped into the air or the water or on the land, so they're part of our ecological footprint too. Not just carbon dioxide from our car exhausts, but what we flush down our toilets and pour down the sink.
When you add all of these things up, you come up with something called the ecological footprint, the actual amount of land producing goods and services in nature required to support a defined population. So if you like, a formal definition of the ecological footprint is the total amount of land and water ecosystems required to produce the resources consumed and to assimilate the wastes produced by a defined population wherever on Earth that land and water is located. Every individual, every population has an ecological footprint on this planet.
Canadians are among the wealthiest people in the world. We have a lavish lifestyle. We drive big cars. We can eat fresh strawberries all year round. We have big houses full of stuff. It takes a lot of land to provide all this. We also need land to absorb the wastes we create, like carbon dioxide. That means we have a very big ecological footprint. Bill Rees has figured out just how big.
Well, we estimate that the ecological footprint of an average Canadian, taking into account food requirements, fiber requirements, our wood requirements, paper requirements, and so on, plus just the assimilation of carbon dioxide, would bring us up to about 7 hectares per capita. So when I say the average Canadian needs 7 hectares of land overall, that brings us up to about 17 acres of biologically productive land of many, many different categories all over the surface of the Earth, dedicated exclusively to the support of every single Canadian given our current material standards.
We Canadians are rich in resources. Lots of other places are less well endowed. What if everything was divvied up equally? Then, how much would each person on the planet be allowed? Bill Rees.
Well, anybody can do the math. The reality is that there's about 6 billion, just under 6 billion people on the Earth right now. There are only about 8.9 billion hectares. And so if you divide the total amount of ecologically productive landscape by the human population, it means that if there were a fair world division here, we'd each get about a hectare and a half of land. Similarly, if you actually look at the productive parts of the ocean, there's only a half a hectare per person, or just over an acre. So in total, what I call the fair earth share per capita, given the present population, would be about 2 hectares of land and water, sufficiently productive to maintain a human being.
So that means you and I, as average Canadians, require 3 to 4 times more than our fair share to keep us in the style to which we are accustomed. What would the consequences be of raising everyone on Earth to our standard of living?
If we were somehow to become more equitable and bring every person on the planet up to Canadian material standards, then it's clear that we would need, if you wanted to be sustainable, a minimum of about 5 additional planet Earths to maintain that level of consumption safely. Now, people say, how can that be? Well, the reason is very simple. The average Canadian consumes vastly more than the average person elsewhere on the planet. In terms of energy consumption, we're 4-fold consumers above everyone else. And if you compare us to the majority of the very poor, we are typically 10 to 40 times more extreme consumers than most people in the more impoverished countries such as India or Bangladesh. So if you increase by a factor of 10 the current levels of consumption of the 3/4 of the people who currently don't consume very much at all up to our levels, then in fact we've computed 4 or 5 planets would be required.
Nature gives us trees and fish, metals and petroleum. But humans create cars, TVs, and jet planes. So we believe it's technology that generates wealth and our way of life. Surely technology, then, makes us less dependent on nature for what we need. Bill Rees.
Now, David, it's really important to get people to understand here that many people just disregard these arguments out of hand. They say, don't worry about it. Human ingenuity will be sufficient to find substitutes for natural processes, substitutes for natural resources, and therefore concern over the future is ill-founded on ecological grounds. The simple fact is, the richer we get, the more technologically advanced we get, the more we appear to be less dependent on nature, but the real reason is that we simply extend our reach a little further, move a little further into the hinterland to appropriate an ever larger flow of resources.
We are air-breathing landlubbers, so we have a natural bias that focuses on the land. Sylvia Earle is a marine biologist who has spent much of her life underwater. She's currently the explorer-in-residence for the National Geographic Society. She says people often ask her, why do we need the oceans?
I've been asked sometimes, what good are the oceans anyway? In fact, a reporter once in Australia said, why should I care? I mean, if the ocean dried up tomorrow, what would it matter to me? I don't eat fish. I don't swim. I get seasick. People don't drink salt water. What good are the oceans? And it put me back a bit, but I've thought a lot about a reasonable response. And I try to imagine, for example, suppose we took this person at her word, and tomorrow the oceans dried up. This planet is governed by the oceans, climate, weather, the nature of the temperature regime, home for most of life on Earth. Something like 95%+ of the biosphere is ocean. Most of the oxygen comes from the sea. Something like 70% of the oxygen is generated by organisms in the ocean. Much of the carbon dioxide is absorbed there. It's a sink for carbon dioxide. If we dried up the oceans, we would do away with a cornerstone of our life support. That's what the oceans really are, after all, the cornerstone of our life support system.
Percent of the planet is covered by oceans. They are alien territory, as mysterious to us as the moon. That has changed recently, thanks to new technologies.
You know, we live in a time of new access with technology that has developed, and I feel so lucky to have been around when simple things like masks and flippers have become available to people such as I and everyone. Little kids can now see what our predecessors could only imagine if they thought about it at all. But more than that, submersibles have developed to the point where now you can go out and buy a ticket and take a ride into the ocean, at least down to 100, 150 feet, or in some cases even deeper, and get a glimpse of what fish see day in, day out, night in, night out, and to understand that the ocean is changing. Fleets of new robotic devices have come about in our lifetime that provide access to depths that we previously haven't known about.
Sylvia Earle has made more than 1,000 deep dives in research submarines, as well as countless scuba dives all around the world. The technology that has allowed her to do this has also enabled us to take unprecedented volumes of fish and shellfish out of the oceans.
Right off the coast of Canada and northern United States, underwater robots have been out to look at the view in Georges Bank and the Grand Banks, and I have to tell you, where people have been out there with scallop dredges, it looks like a superhighway. It looks flat. It looks like a parking lot. But this is like the bulldozer has just gone by. If you go in places where they haven't been scraping the seafloor, it looks hauntingly like a coral reef. They're sponges. There are corals, soft corals, that are beautiful with diverse life, crabs and shrimp and starfish and various kinds of fish, as well as, of course, the targeted species, the scallops, and in a few cases, other creatures that are saved because they are yum, yum, delicious to eat, and so they're kept. But most of what is captured is thrown away. It's like going through the streets of Toronto and knocking down the buildings and trees and picking out a few pedestrians that you might like to munch on, or whatever it is that's your target. Most of the system is simply discarded. And that, unfortunately, is the way a lot of fishing is presently done. Even with all of our state-of-the-art equipment, we still are remarkably crude when it comes to capturing wildlife out of the oceans.
For thousands of years, the oceans were bountiful for people living along their shores. Fish could be caught without reducing their numbers because their reproductive capacity was not diminished. That has all changed. We are mining the ocean's resources, not taking them sustainably.
In the last few decades, we have begun to take devices really developed during World War II and apply them to wage war. You could call it that because it's like that, to wage war on creatures in the ocean, especially on fish, but other creatures as well. Devices to find what is out there in the ocean, acoustic devices, first developed to find enemy submarines, and now being applied to find populations that we don't see until we actually take giant nets, some nets large enough, literally, to engulf something as large as a dozen giant jets in a single swoop through the ocean. In one bite, you could take the equivalent of 12 747 aircraft, for example. The so-called bycatch is enormous, not just from what is taken in trawls that scrape the bottom of the seafloor, consuming the entire ecosystem in the quest for a handful of creatures and everything else is thrown away. And I refuse to use the word harvest because it's a misnomer. When we talk about the ocean or talk about wildlife, we aren't harvesting the sea. We're simply doing what we did with buffalo and songbirds years ago, or wild ducks and geese. We are extracting them, and we are very good at doing so, finding them with acoustic means, then deploying nets down to take whatever is down there.
No one sets out to deliberately trash the very things we need for our survival. But our ability to focus on a challenge, whether it's catching fish or farming the land, can blind us to the linkages that connect all parts of the planet together. Oceans are connected to air and land, and what we do to each of them has repercussions for the others. Our ecological footprint is now massive, and even the vast expanses of the oceans are showing it.
Taking care of the ocean starts at the tops of mountains. That what we do upstream affects everything downstream. That what we put on our backyards or our farms or what we allow to go into the atmosphere flows onto the land and ultimately into the sea. Ultimately, the sea is the sewer for the whole of civilization. Wherever on the planet we live, we are affecting the oceans of the world. We are linked to the sea in every way you can think of, not just the fact that the blood that courses through our veins has haunting similarities to the salinity of the ocean and the composition of seawater itself, but I mean in terms of every breath we take is linked back to the sea through the oxygen that is generated there, and as we exhale, the carbon dioxide generated is linked back to the sea, where much of the carbon dioxide is absorbed. We are dependent on the oceans for our survival and our well-being. And we are in a peculiar position right now in our lifetime of being at a turning point. We have the power to protect the sea and to change our ways in ways that will benefit not just the fish, the whales, the phytoplankton, and all the rest that is out there that we think of as ocean life, but that will very directly have a positive benefit to our future, our health, our wealth, our survival.
Imagine a time-lapse film of the Earth taken from space. Play back the last 10,000 years sped up so that a millennium passes by every minute. For more than 7 minutes, the screen displays what looks like a still photograph, the blue planet Earth, its lands swathed in a mantle of trees. After 7.5 minutes, there's a tiny clearing of forest around Athens. This is the flowering of classical Greece. Little else changes. At 9 minutes, 1,000 years ago, the forest gets thinner in parts of Europe, Central America, China, and India. 12 seconds from the end, 2 centuries ago, the thinning spreads a little further in Europe and China. 6 seconds from the end, Eastern North America is deforested. This is the Industrial Revolution. Little else has changed. In the last 3 seconds, after 1950, the change accelerates explosively. Vast tracts of forest vanish from Japan, the Philippines, and the mainland of Southeast Asia, most of Central America, and the Horn of Africa, from Western North America and Eastern South America, from the Indian subcontinent and Sub-Saharan Africa. Fires rage in the Amazon basin where they never have before. Central Europe's forests die, poisoned by the air and the rain. Southeast Asia looks like a dog with mange. Malaysian Borneo is shaved. In the final fractions of a second, the clearing spread to Siberia and the Canadian North. Forests disappear so quickly from so many places that it looks like a plague of locusts has descended on the earth. That striking visual image was written by a colleague of mine, Alan Durning, an environmentalist working in Seattle. We've only gradually become aware of what's happening to the Earth's forests. During the 1980s, North Americans responded powerfully to images of the burning Amazon rainforest, which was called the lungs of the planet. I live in BC, where we're proud of our spectacular landscape. Our license plates boast of beautiful British Columbia. But flying over the province, we see huge clearings in our temperate rainforest. In fact, some environmentalists refer to BC as the Brazil of the North. As the time-lapse film illustrates, this cutting has happened very recently. The World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C., a research group trying to promote sustainable development, has published a new report on the current state of the Earth's forests. Nigel Sizer was the head of the team that created this survey.
For the first time, World Resources Institute has compared the original forest cover. Basically, we've mapped out what forest there would have been on the planet 8,000 years ago under current climatic conditions, and we compare it with current forest cover. And the results are very striking. What we have discovered with this study is that only 22%, one-fifth, of the world's original forest cover is in anything like a natural or near-natural state. Those forests are concentrated in 3 countries and some scattered amongst a number of other countries. But Brazil, Canada, and Russia account for about 75% of the world's remaining natural or near-natural forest.
The main reason so many of the forests are gone has to do with our ecological footprint. We've been logging those forests for pulp and fiber and lumber to support our way of life. Now, there are so few left that there's a kind of gold rush for the remaining trees, and prospectors are active around the planet. Nigel Sizer.
Malaysia Indonesia and some other countries in Southeast Asia, such as South Korea, have witnessed the development of very large domestic logging operations. These countries are very rich in forest with very large numbers of high-value timber species in them. And companies in that part of the world, logging companies in that part of the world, have become very, very rich in the space of the last 10 or 20 years. They've paid very low taxes. They've worked often in cahoots with their governments to access areas very cheaply. They're sitting now on top of billions of dollars in cash, plus billions more that's offered to them through the stock markets of the region. And they're looking to expand. They cannot expand any more in those countries. The forest has already been allocated to the companies. So they're moving around the world very quickly after the last great forest frontiers that remain elsewhere. Amazonia, Central Africa, Russia, and even Canada and the United States are now experiencing significant amounts of investment by these companies, billions of dollars of investment flowing now from Southeast Asia, exporting forest destruction from those countries to other parts of the world.
Canada is one of the few countries in the world with much of its original forest cover left. Just south of the Arctic tundra lies the boreal forest. It's not as lush as a tropical rainforest, but it's a vast and unique ecosystem. And it's just as important for removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and pumping out oxygen. It's not just countries like Brazil, Indonesia, and Zaire that need to keep their forest cover intact. Canada does too.
In Canada, this situation is strikingly similar to the situation in many developing countries, and that may surprise some Canadians. But as an international organization working around the world, we do see these parallels. We see a very tight connection between the political system and politicians and campaign financing and the operations and interests of the large pulp and paper and timber companies in that country. We see very limited public access to objective information about the state of Canada's forests. We collect global statistics on forests. Canada is one of the countries with the poorest national statistics on the state of their forests, which is very striking when you consider that the forest industry is one of the largest industries in Canada, and that this is a country with the expertise, the ability, and the resources to collect better statistics than just about anywhere else. This is a striking situation, and I don't think it's a coincidence. In our work mapping out global forest condition, the country where we received the most conflicting information and the most concerted pressure to ensure that we reflected this or that point of view was Canada, more than Brazil, more than Indonesia, more than Russia. I think that says a lot.
People have always used forests. The great indigenous cultures of the Pacific Northwest, with their totem poles, longhouses, and canoes, were based on wood. The challenge is to use forests sustainably. Modern industrial forestry is on a different scale and is not sustainable. Our remaining ancient forests harbor tens of thousands of years of evolutionary secrets. They are priceless beyond measure and must be protected.
The big challenge is now to restore natural forest ecosystems, and that is perfectly possible. There are a number of grand visions and grand projects beginning to be put together, which map out large areas of the landscape that potentially could be covered once again with natural forest, and the ecosystem functions of that forest restored in their entirety. These are 50, 100, 200-year projects, but perfectly within the realm of human capability.
The atmosphere is a complex mix of gases that gives us our weather and climate. It's like an immense blanket that envelops the world and has maintained a temperature conducive to life. Very recently, that started to change. Stephen Schneider is a climatologist. He spent 20 years at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, and is currently a professor at Stanford. Is the climate of the planet changing?
Well, the words global warming have become almost a battle cry for various factions in the world who, quote, believe or don't believe, who think it's serious or not serious. Yet, despite the large number of uncertainties surrounding the climate change debate, the actual existence of global warming is a fact established virtually beyond doubt. That is, if we look at the thermometers of the world and see what they've done over the last century, the world is about a half degree Celsius or so, or warmer than it was a century ago. Mountain glaciers have receded virtually all around the world, and many are disappearing at a rapid rate. And the sea levels have risen, something on the order of 10 to 20 centimeters, and those are all consistent with warming. In fact, looks at historical records convince us that the last two decades are the warmest in the past 1,000 years. So that's not the debate. Only a few people assert that not to be true. They keep repeating that assertion, and because they have PhDs, they keep getting equal status with the vast bulk of the community, which says, no, there really is global warming.
If the average person remains confused, part of the reason is that most of the media still report global warming as if it's a controversy. They stack most scientists, like Schneider, who say it is warming, on one side, against a small group who say the proof isn't in. Steve Schneider says the real question among scientists is what's causing the warming.
The debate is whether that warming is just a perverse act of nature or whether this is something that humans have done through their increasing numbers of people demanding higher standards of living and using technologies which change the land surface and dump pollutants in the atmosphere that could have created it. That's the controversy among the knowledgeable scientific community, not whether the warming itself exists, which is a virtual fact.
The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, made up of more than 2,000 scientists, has concluded that there is overwhelming evidence that we are a major cause of the warming that is happening now. The problem is, our technological age is powered by the burning of large quantities of fossil fuels that build up in our atmosphere. It's the accumulation of greenhouse gases that's creating the problem. But scientists don't know how much the temperature will rise. Steve Schneider.
So there's a big debate that's legitimate about how much the system is going to warm up, and which is the reason why the last 20 years worth of assessments have said that somewhere between about 1 and 4 degrees warming in the next century is our best range. And, you know, 1 degree is on my view, tolerable unless you happen to be creatures living in the tundra or in mountaintops that will get pushed out of existence. By and large, most of us could adapt to 1 degree, but 4 degrees is virtually the difference between an ice age and a warm epoch like we're in now, and it takes nature 10,000 years to make those kinds of changes, and we're talking about changes like that on the order of a century, and there isn't an ecologist anywhere who thinks that we can adapt to that without dramatic dislocation to the species of the world and to agriculture and other patterns of living which depend on the climate.
The ecological consequences of temperature change could be catastrophic, so it's important to know whether it will be 1 degree or 4 degrees. Computer models of global climate are extremely sophisticated and accurately describe current weather trends. But our knowledge base is still pretty primitive. We can only take a stab at predicting what the global consequences of warming might be.
Could what we're doing now cause something irreversible? Something we can't say, oops, let's back out of that. Well, unfortunately, the answer is very definitely yes, and climatologists call these surprise scenarios. They're really imaginable, because if it was truly a surprise, you wouldn't be able to even guess. We already have a whole bunch of candidates. If you change climate rapidly enough, and we're not smart enough to know what enough is yet, we think that we're getting toward that limit, but we're not really sure. It's a coin flip, basically. You could reorient the Gulf Stream, which could see the irony of the world warming up and Europe freezing down. Well, that would be a very, very catastrophic scenario for the planet, let alone, you know, for Europe. Other irreversible events could be the beginning of the destruction of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which could raise sea level by many meters. Now, it will take hundreds of years for that scenario to play itself out. But once it starts, we can say, oops, changed our mind, don't need this, invented a new technology. Too late. It started, and you can't stop it.
We can't afford to say, oops, too late. Scientists and engineers know there are all kinds of ways to significantly reduce our fossil fuel use. If we would only make the commitment and start to do it, it would reduce the dangers of climate change and shrink our ecological footprint as well. There's still time, but if we delay, the damage will be permanent. Steve Schneider.
If we don't start slowing it down now and buy ourselves time to find out where these irreversibilities and where these surprises are, then we may very well be risking them without any capacity to do anything about it, no matter how much money we spend on it in the future. The bottom line is that we're performing an experiment, but this experiment is not in some ivory-covered hall in some university or a government lab. This is an experiment out there on the trees and the insects and us, and I've called this Laboratory Earth. And when we're performing an experiment on us and we don't really know the consequences, I think that good judgment and prudence calls for slowing it down until we know what we're doing.
Many people call us up and they can't even pronounce the chemicals. It's like, I got this chemical. I don't know what it means. I don't know how to pronounce it, but can I spell it for you? And will you tell me what it means? It's in my water. It's in my food. It's in my air. And we're scared.
Lois Gibbs is an environmental activist. When she was a young housewife back in the 70s, she lived with her husband and two young children in a suburb called Love Canal, near Niagara Falls in Upper New York State. The new subdivision was built over a former industrial site. Nobody thought anything about it until a lot of the residents started to have health problems, especially the children.
My two children, who were raised in part at Love Canal, were both affected as a result. Michael, who was perfectly healthy when we moved in, he was 1 year old. After living there for 4 years, he developed asthma, epilepsy, a urinary tract problem which required two operations to correct. He developed an immune system problem where he had a depressed immune system, very similar to an AIDS victim, except for his was not viral or contagious in any sort of way. I mean, it was just one thing after the other. Melissa, who was conceived and carried at Love Canal, developed a rare blood disease, where her body thought her platelets, that's what clots your blood, was a foreign object. And so her body started to destroy its platelets, and she was hemorrhaging internally. And she had a very high risk and still has a very high risk of leukemia as a result of that disease.
Lois Gibbs was very frightened and at a loss to understand her children's health problems. Nothing in her background prepared her for this.
I had a high school education, a C average. My goal in life was to be a homemaker. You know, I didn't study algebra or chemistry because I didn't need that to bake a better cake, to change a diaper, to clean my house. So when I first found out about Love Canal, I actually read in a newspaper. For many years, I was asking my pediatrician, why is Michael so sick? I'm healthy, my husband's healthy, my family has a history of health. And he kept saying he didn't know. And then I read in this newspaper that says all these chemicals are at Love Canal. And the newspaper also talked about diseases and symptoms that come from exposure, mostly workplace exposure to these chemicals. And I'm reading this newspaper and I see epilepsy, asthma, depressed immune system, blood disorders, leukemia. And I'm checking off my kids' problems and it was like, whoa. This is really scary.
But it was not in Lois's nature to make a fuss. Like most of us, she assumed someone in charge would know what to do.
And at first, I wasn't about to go out and do anything about it. I figured if I was scared, other people were scared. And so if I waited, soon somebody would come knock on my door who was much smarter and much more skilled than me and say, we want to do something about this problem. And so I did wait. I waited for over a month, but nobody came knocking on my door. And so Michael got very sick, and he was in the hospital, and that was sort of the turning point for me. When I'm looking at his white little face and his white little bed with the white little sheets, and I'm looking at him saying, you know, the reason he's sick here is not just Love Canal, it's not the city and the government's fault, it's my fault. I made a decision that I would sit back and wait for somebody else to come and do this. And when they didn't come, I didn't do anything. And what kind of responsible mother could I possibly be if I sat back knowing my children were being poisoned? And that's when I got up enough courage to go to the very first door and begin to talk to people.
Lois Gibbs got the neighbors together. They compared their health problems and they started to organize. They made it their business to find out just what it was that was making them ill. They discovered that their homes and playgrounds were built over 20,000 tons of mixed chemicals, mostly solvents and pesticides, buried there by a chemical company. It was a toxic brew.
Many families got sick at Love Canal. We had statistics that showed that 56% of the children born were born with birth defects, ranging from 3 ears to extra rows of teeth, extra fingers, extra toes, or mentally retarded. We found that the women at Love Canal gave birth statistically higher to low birth weight babies than in other communities. We had more miscarriages in stillborn children than other communities, and central nervous system problems, and so on.
Lois Gibbs was transformed into an environmental activist. She rallied her neighbors to protest the actions of the chemical company and demand that the government do something. After years of fighting, they won. They received enough money to move away from Love Canal.
I was trying to figure out, after we were all bought out at Love Canal, what am I going to do? And, you know, do I want to go back and be a homemaker, and exactly what's my future? And I received this phone call for this woman in Texas, Brownsville, Texas. She said her 7-year-old son had brain cancer, and there were many children in her neighborhood with brain cancer, that he was going to die, that he probably only has 6 to 8 weeks left. And after he passed on, she wanted to do something about it. She didn't want his death to be in vain. And could I help her figure out what to do? And that was a turning point for me, because it was like, there are many people out there who are not doing this because of professional growth, but they're doing it because their children are dying. And somebody somewhere knew that that community was being poisoned. And somebody somewhere gave a permit, which is a license to kill as far as I'm concerned, for that little boy. And somebody has to be stopped. And the only way we can stop them is to take what I learned at Love Canal from a community's creativity and empowerment, and build a national group of moms and dads and factory workers and farmers and ranchers, and bring them together to say, this has got to stop. We can no longer allow children to be sacrificed for profit.
The tragedy at Love Canal was a wake-up call about our industrial wastes. Now we know how much harm they can do to us and to all living things. We know there are big costs involved in cleanups, but the cost of not cleaning them up is bigger. We've used air, water, and soil as a dump for toxic chemicals because it was cheap and easy. But now, thanks to people like Lois Gibbs, we know there are unacceptable costs of doing business this way. The good news is when we turn our priorities to preventing the production of toxics in the first place, it can be done. All it takes is the incentive. And there's more good news. When we reduce our ecological footprint, forests come back, fish flourish, and people heal.
since we moved from Love Canal, which is a good side. I mean, there is a good side to this, that I think the families, not only my family, but other families, have clearly shown that if you remove people from exposure, they can become well. Their bodies can heal themselves. Melissa's blood count is now within normal limits. All of Michael's diseases are gone, except for his asthma. And many of the other families report similar things. I mean, they kept on telling me his urinary tract disorder is just going to be chronic, it'll be a lifetime thing. It's not. 1 year after leaving Love Canal, it disappeared. And then I thought, well, maybe this is just coincidence. But when you look at the hematology clinic results for Melissa's blood, you actually could see the levels of platelets increasing over time. And if you looked at the brainwave test from Michael's epilepsy, you could see his epilepsy actually disappearing. And so it isn't coincidence, and the body is an amazing instrument. And if we can remove ourselves from these chemicals, we can heal. And I think the other plus side to that is that our grandbabies and their children have much more of a potential to be healthier individuals if we can remove these chemicals from our environment, from our food and our water.
Nature is resilient, but the ecological footprint analysis informs us that the party is over. We've improved our standard of living by ignoring the ecological costs, and now it's caught up to us. Bill Rees.
We've spent 30 years now creating a market economy and extending it to the rest of the world, in which the primary belief is that human welfare springs from increased production and consumption, or if you like, increased income. Now, that model is pervasive, and it's growing, and it's extended everywhere. But it's even a perversion of good economics, because any real good economist will admit that welfare is not merely an increase in income or consumptive capacity. It includes a stable ecological environment. It includes safe cities. It includes healthy urban environments. It includes the ability to walk down your street without the fear of being mugged. So what I'm really arguing here is that we've caved in globally to a model of progress which equates human welfare to mere increase in income or consumptive capacity. The reality is that this is a perversion of good economics. There is much more to life than income increase, that technology is not going to be able to save the day, certainly not without the aid of government. Governments must intervene in this economy. What I'm saying, David, is we've got the world wrong.
Today, the global economy is held up as if it's the triumph of human creativity and innovation. But its success is an illusion, made possible only by leaving the real world out of the equation. Marine biologist Sylvia Earle.
As far as I can see, there's just growing evidence all around as we begin to put on the balance sheet things that really do have a cost associated with them that we haven't really accounted for before. That air is not exactly free, and we learn that quickly when we start to recognize what we have to do to take contaminants out of the air. There's a real cost associated with pollution that we heretofore, or at least in go back a few decades, had not put on the balance sheet. We think of fish as free. Fish are not free. Air is not free. Clean water is not free. There's a real cost to our health. There's a real cost to our future. But even beyond that, when you think about the sound economy has to be rooted in a sound environment. These are not elements of our society that are in opposition. It's all part of a whole. Our whole entire economy is reliant on the existence of the environment. Tim Wirth has summed it up by saying, you know, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. We all go back to the environment as the basis of our life.